In those days, they were called Bunk's Boys, and they went on to head up the Smithsonian, University of California, Berkeley, University of Michigan, all sorts of these. They were the who's who of the 20th century, mid-20th century naturalists.
That's Chuck Warner, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Chuck Warner joins us to talk about his book, Birds, Bones, and Beetles, The Improbable Career and Remarkable Legacy of University of Kansas Naturalist Charles D. Bunker. Chuck Warner is the grandson of Charles D. Bunker. Chuck, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Tell us about what inspired you to write this book.
Well, the book is about my grandfather, and in 2009, we had a family reunion. My brother's family from California came, and my family is around the Kansas City area, and we arranged for a behind-the-scenes tour at the Natural History Museum. And the curator that took us on the tour asked if, during the tour, if we had any interest in seeing his field notes, Grandpa Bunker's field notes. And I don't have a science background. I didn't even know what field notes were. And I said, sure, fine. And he encouraged me or my daughter to write a book about him. So we took the field notes, borrowed those, and got to find out more about Grandpa Bunker and what he did, because we didn't know much about him. When he died, I was 2 years old, so I have no direct recollection of him. So started working on doing a book and started with these field notes because they had his trips in 1911, 1912, 1919.
So obviously, as a family member, you were interested in learning more about him. But at what point did you decide, now this is a story that I think the public should know about?
Because I don't have a science background, it took me a while to figure out that he didn't seem to be the normal person you write a book about. When they said you should write a book about him, I'm sitting there going, there's books about Lewis Lindsay Dyke, Williston, Frank Snow, all these people, the famous people at the university and tied it and connected to the museum. And he's like, he didn't fit that. And then I realized that he really made a lot of contributions. And the more I dug, the more I found out it was important for me to tell the story about somebody who wasn't leading the charge. And, you know, he was very quiet, unassuming. He even had stage fright, so he didn't like public speaking, but he was really good working one-on-one with the students. So that was a story that I felt should be told.
As you started doing this research, as you mentioned, you had those field notes, but to sort of fill in the details of his life, how were you able to research that and learn more about the man himself?
Well, there were a few documents. There was a in memoriam that was written by E. Raymond Hall a couple of years after Bunker had passed away. But he didn't have a body of letters. I mean, it was really hard to research. L.L. Dyke had 11 boxes of correspondence and things at the Spencer. And Bunker had one and was only half full. So I really had to go around the corners to find things. And it ended up, I found a lot of stuff in like Chancellor's correspondence, things like that at the Spencer. So it was a challenge.
Well, tell us a little bit about his life and how he ended up coming to the museum.
He grew up in Mendota, Illinois. His parents were working class folks. His dad was a carpenter. Mom stayed at home, raised the 7 kids. Bunker was born in 1870. And in 1889, his dad lost his job as a cabinet maker for a musical organ company there in Mendota. So he was out of work. Well, Mendota had been a railroad town, and it was in its heyday during the Western expansion in the 1850s. And by 1889, there weren't any jobs to be had. So he finds a job at Haskell Institute in Lawrence, Kansas, teaching wagon making to the students. So that's what brought them here in 1891.
And did he display any interest early on as a child, and that eventually led to him as an adult getting this job at the museum here at the university?
When he was young, he had childhood illness that kept him home from school a lot. And that was what contributed to him not finishing past the 8th grade. But it was also part of recommendation, medical advice, was that he spend time outdoors. So he spent a lot of time out in nature. He learned to hunt. You know, he just liked being outdoors, and that fit him well. He also found a guy named Mr. Banning, and that's all we know of his name. He was lived on a farm outside of Mendota, and he had a taxidermy shop. Now, it wasn't like taxidermy they were doing at the university. He was basically mounting birds that he sold to saloons. And I think it was a good business plan because it was a railroad town, so there were lots of saloons in Mendota. But that's what got him interested. So when he came to KU and started looking for a job, the first place he wanted to look for a job was as a taxidermist, but there weren't any jobs. There wasn't even a taxidermy shop in town, but there was the university. And so that's where he eventually got on, though it took him several years and lots of tries to convince Dyke that he should hire him.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you mentioned, his education was only to the eighth grade level, so it was kind of unusual for someone that didn't have a degree or other kinds of specialized education to land a job at the university, I would think.
Right. When he went to work there, there were still a number of taxidermists on staff because they had done all those animals that are in today's panorama for the 1893 World's Fair of the Columbian Exhibition in Chicago. So they had some staff jobs like that that were not academic. They would process the specimens mm-hmm. and put them into the collection and do those sorts of things. So there were a few on there, but there weren't that many. So he just waited them out, and finally in 1895, when he was hired at the university, Dyke had just returned from the Arctic Circle in Greenland, and he had all those, you know, the polar bear and the walrus and the seals and all those animals from the Arctic Circle. So he had stuff that needed to be done. He had a lot of work that needed to be done.
Well, as his career advanced within the museum, he was instrumental in building some of the collections. Tell us about that.
Yes, he did a lot of work building the collection. One of the things that's probably the favorite local spot was the what they used to call Bunk's Cabin, and it was 7.5 miles southeast of town, and it was out on the Lone Star Road, out off of that a ways. On the weekends, he would take students, and he'd go out there to hunt, primarily for them to learn how to collect, and he went out there with the pretense that he was going to chop wood, and they could go along and hunt. And they go out there and spend the weekend days hunting and collecting specimens and getting them prepared, have to identify them. He taught them all the full process and then what they needed to do to get them put in the collection drawers and things like that. That was also a time where the museum was moving away from large taxidermy projects more to collection specimens for the drawers, smaller ones, more common ones, if you will.
So he would go on these expeditions with the students as an educational thing for them. But give us an idea of how far and wide he traveled during his career with the museum to gather specimens.
Well, once the panorama was pretty much complete in 1911, the Kansas Biological Survey was formed. And this was common in lots of states. They were trying to survey all the species of animals in the state. So they would send teams out. Well, in the summer of 1911, Bunker and Theo Rockland, another assistant at the university, they embarked on a trip at the 1st of May, and they didn't get really finished until the fall when it snowed. They came home for 6 weeks in the middle of it. And so that was one of their larger trips. It's probably 1,000 miles. And they were in a wagon with two horses, and it was really primitive, and they collected thousands of specimens, and the next year they came back. And then there were a few times where they'd go, like to New Mexico back in the 30s, but most of the time, most of his was around local.
Well, one of the things that is on display at the museum is the giant sea serpent
right.
that he uncovered. So that's a replica, as I understand, that's
correct.
On display. But tell us about how that came about.
Well, in 1911, when they were traveling to western Kansas, the first stop was Gypsum Hills. Spent a couple weeks collecting there. They went over to the Cimarron River further west along the Oklahoma border. They spent a couple of weeks there. And then they headed up the western edge of the state toward Wallace County. The plan was that they would meet Handel Martin. The fossil people would come out on the train. Bunk and Theo would turn the horses and wagon over to them, and they'd go hunt fossils, and then they'd come back for rest, and they'd come back in the fall and take the wagon back over, and the fossil guys would go home. Well, Martin didn't get out there soon enough. They got there before Martin could get there. They had hunted, and it was the middle. It was like end of June. It was hot. The birds weren't flying. That was most of what they were birds and mammals. Where they were hunting small mammals. During the days, they didn't have anything to do, and there was an old guy out there, a rancher named George Alleman, who knew about all of the old fossil expeditions. Now, Bunker never worked in the fossil world, but the Dyke Hall was small. He was around. He'd seen Williston. He knew Handel Martin. He knew, they kind of knew. They didn't stay in their silos like they would today. So Alleman suggested they go look for fossils because there were a lot of them out there. Western Kansas was all underwater 60 million years ago, and that's why all these aquatic fossils are so prevalent out there. They're just, you know, world-renowned from fossil people know that there were a lot of good things to collect out there. So they found one, and they cleaned that out and took it out and everything, and then they found another one. Well, this one was the big one. This was the one that he wrote about in his field notes that he didn't have a measuring tape, so he measured it against his shovel, and he says it was, you know, a foot longer than the shovel, and so that made it about 4 to 5 feet long was the jawbone. This was what he was measuring. And by that, he could extrapolate the size and it was going to be big. And yet, he always understated things. He never was one to get excited. And he put something in his notes about, well, I got to go home and get cleaned up for the 4th of July picnic. It was like, no big deal. But it was a big deal. It turned out it was probably the largest specimen in North America of that mosasaur, and it also became the state marine reptile for the state of Kansas just a couple of years ago. So it was a big find, and they didn't know what it was for until almost the 1990s. They were discussing what it was.
In your prologue, you write that the life of Charles Bunker illustrates how those who live quiet lives can still make a significant difference in the world around them. What do you see as the legacy of Charles D. Bunker?
Well, I think that's one of his big legacies, that the life he led was so common, but it really impacted. And his real legacy was his students. There were hundreds of students that came under his mentorship, his tutelage, taught him how to collect. And these guys, and mostly guys, there were reportedly a couple of women at that time. But in those days, they were called Bunk's Boys, and they went on to head up the Smithsonian, University of California, Berkeley, University of Michigan, all sorts of these. They were the who's who of the mid-20th century naturalists. And they all attributed to, you know, to Bunker. We even had a chancellor. The university was one of his boys, Chancellor Malott. So he was very influential, and I think that was his legacy, was he set all these guys out in the world to do good things. And he could identify, or he was just lucky, I don't know, but that was his legacy.
The book is available through University Press, but you're also doing some readings of the book, and you have one coming up in June. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Natural History Museum, they have this program that the relationship they have with the Free State Brewery, they call it Science on Tap, and they have people come and speak about different things about science. So they were nice enough to include me in one in June the 19th, a Wednesday night at the Free State Brewery at 7:30. And I think that should be an interesting venue for a book talk. So looking forward to that.
Well, Chuck, thank you very much for talking with me today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Chuck Warner's book is Birds, Bones, and Beetles, The Improbable Career and Remarkable Legacy of University of Kansas Naturalist Charles D. Bunker. You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. You can use the KPR app to listen to Conversations on your phone or tablet. You can sign up for the Conversations podcast on iTunes, and you'll also find us on Facebook. Conversations is a production of Kansas Public Radio. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.